So we're going to do something a little different. I'm Chris Cuomo. You know me. I'm the guy who says, let's get after it. We're going to do exactly that with brother of the show, who subs in for me so excellently so often, PJ Rykoff. He has an interesting new piece on CNN.com that you may read about veterans being used as guinea pigs to test hydroxychloroquine, and he's worried about it. And I also want to talk to him about what is happening in this kind of disconnect between the military and the commander-in-chief on renaming bases and installations that currently have Confederate military leader or commander names on them. And the president's response was, we got to be careful about respecting our history, and we have to respect our military. But what does respecting our military have to do with keeping the names of Confederate commanders who are not our military on the bases? So, PJ, you there, brother?
I am. Captain Cuomo, great to be back with you and on the Let's Get After It community. I miss you. I miss your listeners. I miss Vicky and the crew. And it's
we miss you too, bud.
So, what is your diagnosis of the Pentagon making noises about changing the names of places that have Confederate commanders, and whether or not that'll happen, with the commander-in-chief seeming to be sideways about it?
Long overdue, absolutely necessary, supported by, it seems like, most of the rank and file and senior leadership. I think it's important, Chris, to note that the Marine Corps just last week finally banned Confederate flags. Believe it or not, they actually weren't banned. So until recently, you could have a flag in the barracks, you could have a Confederate flag on your coffee cup, you could be a, you know, a white commander commanding black soldiers and have a Confederate flag flying, and it wasn't against the regs. Now that's finally against the regs. So I think this is moving very fast, and it seems like an island here. The Air Force is moving forward pretty quickly. The Army has now said they want to go through a three-year study to analyze this basis, but the names of other installations, of ships, they've got to do it, Chris. I mean, I served at Fort Benning as an infantryman. Fort Benning is named after a traitor.
Right.
A racist traitor who left America to fight America. And that's where I was taught, you know, in the infantry school. So it's long overdue. They can name it after somebody like General Omar Bradley, who was a champion for the infantry. It's long overdue. President, as usual, is really out of step, and maybe with the military that he's ever been. You know, Mullen, spoken out against him recently. Colin Powell spoken out recently. But now, even General Milley has spoken out in the last couple of hours, saying that he was wrong to do the tour over to St. John's Church in his uniform. So it's the first time somebody that close to him has bucked him, and I think it may be a new trend.
And what is the point? Wait, hold on. Let me ask you something else first. Do you think any of that will happen, and the renaming and all that, if the commander-in-chief is against it?
I don't know the technicalities, to be honest with you, but I think it will happen eventually anyway. But, you know, they usually take a couple of years to do this sort of thing. I mean, if you just think about what different things they're going to have to change on a military base that's essentially a town. Right, like when you have a Fort Benning, it's the post office, it's the school, it's the letterhead, it's everything. It takes a while to just change a name, so I think that would probably take them a year or two. Anyway, if Trump loses, I think that, you know, it'll happen with the quickness. If he wins, he can try to dig in, but I think public opinion is not on his side on this, even within the military. And the Joint Chiefs have seemed to have been able to get to him. I think they got him to back down on using the active duty against protesters. They pushed him in other areas like Afghanistan. They've gotten him to back down at times, and I think they can really put him in a corner, especially in the election.
Okay, so there's that issue. Now let's segue into your other specific concern about veterans. How do you know that veterans are being used to test hydroxychloroquine in a way that you believe is abusive of them, instead of giving them an opportunity to take a drug that may help them?
Because the Secretary of Veterans Affairs has admitted it. He admitted it with Stephanie Ruhle on MSNBC. He did it again with Martha Lewis on ABC. Then he did it in testimony before the Veterans Affairs Committee. He said that they are using hydroxychloroquine on veterans, mostly World War II veterans, who were in their last stages of life. And I think most disturbingly, he says it works. He says it works as a prophylactic. He says that it works with younger vets. And to our knowledge, to Dr. Fauci's knowledge, to the WHO's knowledge, there is no evidence to support that. So the question is, you know, why are they testing something that's unproven on America's heroes in their dying days? World War II vets for hydroxychloroquine or anything else. And, you know, you and I have talked about this on your TV show. They're dying at a very high rate. A lot of these state homes have lost dozens of World War II veterans, and most of the World War II veterans that you see dying are not necessarily even counted because they're not in veterans' homes. They're dying in civilian hospitals or even on the streets if they're homeless. So we don't know how many are dead, but we know that they've tested a number of them, and they're not stopping.
And you believe that this, you know, because, look, the president thinks it works. There's some anecdotal evidence that it can help. They are doing more research on it. One of the studies that had said, no, don't do the research on it, it doesn't work, the researchers had to back away. Because they couldn't verify their own data, once again opening the door that maybe this thing can be helpful. What makes you so sure? Look, let me put it a different way, Peach. You don't know that they're not giving this drug to these people because, especially those who are near the end of their lives, because that's what the cases that are most extreme is where it's potentially most effective, in a way that they think is salubrious, that is good for them, as opposed to just seeing whether or not they can get data out of them before they die, right?
Well, the early reports said that they were, you know, four times more likely to have a cardiac issue, and triple the number of them were reported to have been dying. Now, that some of that data has been walked back, but if that data is out there, why go forward with the test? I mean, this was a point where France was banning it, where the WHO was issuing warnings. Everybody was saying this could be very dangerous for people with COVID-19. Now, they said they've used it on tens of thousands of people in the VA system, and they have, but for malaria, not for COVID-19. So the question becomes, how do they know it's not killing them? It very well could be killing more of them at a higher rate, and we just don't know. So it's really, it's an example of seeing them as guinea pigs. I don't know how else to put it. Schumer called it, that's what many veterans groups have been calling it. And most importantly, Wilkie is either lying or misrepresenting the information. I haven't seen any scientific data to support that it works on younger vets, which is what he said in public. Seeing that, Chris, I don't know where he's getting it from.
And what do you think should be done?
They should stop. They should stop and come clean and tell us how many they've tested, if they have any scientific data. And a very important point, too, Chris, I mean, you've been through this in a way that nobody else could understand. You've been through it. But if you've got a 96-year-old World War II veteran, he's on his deathbed, at what point do you have a conversation with him about hydroxychloroquine? How does that conversation go down, right? How is the family informed? For example, in Holyoke, Massachusetts, over 90 veterans died in one facility. You've been tracking on this in your show and doing it. Over 90 of them. Their families couldn't even get in there. So are they unconscious? How do you sign off on an experimental drug literally on your deathbed? I think those are the kinds of questions that the American people have a right to know, and the veterans community especially has a right to know.
Now, let's expand the conversation a little bit in terms of what you see going on in the country right now and what you think suggests where we're going, and what do you think still needs to be done to get the kinds of change that are being called for by people in the streets?
You know, it's dangerous times right now, Chris. And you know, again, the military is thrust in the middle of it. You've got over 25 states that have deployed National Guardsmen. They're put in, I think, the toughest spot you could ever imagine. It's tougher than any spot I've been in Iraq. I think it's even tougher than Vietnam or Korea or anywhere else. The idea that you could be standing across from American civilians on American soil with loaded weapons is really the worst scenario you could put our young men and women in. So I think I'm glad to see that it's been ratcheted down, but I think we got to brace ourselves for difficult times, and we have to, I think, especially be mindful of the fact that the president is trying to use the military as his ground force for his political agenda. And that's why you see Admiral Mullen and Powell and so many others pushing back. This is really uncharted territories. The military is not there to be his ground force in some kind of political agenda. And that's really what
he says. He's trying to keep places safe. You got people who wouldn't get out of Lafayette Park. Now you have Seattle and what's going on there. and that, you know, he's got to step in because others are too weak. And even if that means using the military, it's the right thing to do. What do you think?
Well, the National Guard is run by the state governor on the ground. So the state governor on the ground is like a battlefield. If you want to use Esper's bad term, Secretary of Defense Esper called it the battlefield. I wouldn't call it that. But if you want to say that the governors are in charge of their own battle space, those 50 states, they make the calls. The National Guard, you know, answers to your brother in the state of New York. When I'm in the National Guard, that's who would be my commander at the time, unless he federalized. And he shouldn't federalize them, frankly, unless the governors think they need it. And the governors have told them they don't need it. They have adequate resources with their police, with the National Guard, and it will actually, I think, escalate the situation if you bring in, for example, the 82nd Airborne, which is what they did. They brought the 82nd Airborne into Washington, D.C., told them they were going home. Then they told them they were staying. Then they told them they were going home again. So this group of guys and gals were flown into Washington for a really tough situation, and they got jerked around again, which is what's happened to them really the last years under the Trump administration. So it's bad stuff, Chris, and I think it's really dangerous on a level we've never seen before with the modern military.
And why do you think that is, that we've never seen it before?
We've never had Trump before. I mean, he is President Mayhem. I mean, and the mayhem that he has imposed upon his country, I think is everywhere, but it's nowhere more dangerous than in the military. This is a guy who took funds away from to pay for the wall. This is the guy who ripped our troops away from our allies in Kurdistan. Right now, he's threatening to pull out 10,000 troops out of Germany, out of Eastern Europe, which most military advisors are saying is a bad idea that benefits Russia. So consistently, he's been on the wrong side of the issues in the interest of our national defense, and that's why he keeps moving through Secretary of Defense. You know, now Mattis is finally speaking out. Nobody's in a better position to really criticize what he's done for our national security than Mattis. We all wish he said it sooner, but now he's finally out there. And I think he could be maybe the most damaging political player on this battlefield going into 2020. General Mattis can do things to Donald Trump that Joe Biden never could. It'll really hurt him with independence, and it'll hurt him with those folks who focus on national security and are much more hurt.
Will it, or does he become marginalized as a political person the same way that Brennan has?
You know, he's tried that. I mean, Mattis is called St. Mattis in the Marine Corps. I mean, there are literally shrines on the desks of Marines for General Mattis. So he has a very hallowed reputation that I don't think Trump is gonna tangle with effectively. If he chooses to, I think he'll lose. I mean, Mattis is a soldier. He's been very careful in his criticism. And I think you'll find that he could be very, very powerful. He doesn't want to be political. That's what you've heard from so many of these folks like General Dempsey and others. They don't want to be political, but they feel like the times have required it and the urgency has required it and the failures of leadership by President Trump have required it. So, you know, this is a whole new realm for us, and I think you're going to see more folks like that engaged, maybe even endorse Biden. You know, having Colin Powell endorse Biden this early is historic and I think will be impactful.
How much does it mean that Mattis didn't say any of this when he was in there?
You know, we don't ever know what he said when he was in there, Chris. I think that's the hard part, but he could have said something a lot sooner. I think all of us were hoping when he first came out, he would challenge the president. He would speak his mind. We knew he had reservations. He said he resigned, and then the president said he fired him, which is always the case with everybody in the cabinet. But Mattis has been quiet for a long, long time. And in that period of time, a lot of damage has been done. And we've got, you know, Secretary Esper, whose nickname in the Pentagon right now is Yesper, because he does everything that Trump says. Consistently, he sides Trump on political issues instead of siding. So I personally wish Mattis would have spoke out earlier. But better late than never. Things definitely could get a lot worse. We saw that with tension around the protests. And I think Mattis is going to be formidable, and he's going to hurt Trump in ways Trump has never seen before.
Why are you so sure of that? How do you know he'll even be that active in the campaign?
Well, he doesn't have to. I mean, that's the good part. I mean, he put out one piece last week that got headlines across the globe. Because he's a principled guy, I don't think he's going to go and do the nightly talk shows. He's going to pick his spots. And that resonates, especially among the rank and file that are still in the active duty. They vote, right, Chris? And they can't always speak out. They're not always going to get involved in partisan politics, but they're going to listen to the leaders like Mattis. And this hits Trump where it hurts. I mean, this hits him among conservatives. It hits him among the military. It hits him among his base in red states. So that could, you know, mean the difference in a place like Pennsylvania or Florida. He doesn't have to go out in the campaign and stump. But if he gets people to think twice before they pull that lever, that could be the difference in a swing state.
And let me ask you, on the General Flynn situation, is that playing for you in your circle as they came after Flynn for bad reason because he is a supporter of the president? Or do people believe that he is getting preferential treatment as an ally of Trump?
I think it's the latter. I think people think, for the most part, that Flynn is a disgrace to the uniform. And he had opportunities where he could have made the right choice, and he made the wrong choice consistently. And you know, now he, again, is one of the many who've chosen politics over patriotism. And that's how history will write his final closing. I mean, maybe there'll be a point where he comes out and sings like a songbird and tries to make up for it. But I think it's, especially when you think of a community that considers honor and integrity and values, you know, Flynn violated all of that. So, you know, in many ways, he sold out the veterans and military community for the politics. And that's unfortunately what Trump's gotten so many folks to do, whether in uniform or not.
You think military votes differently in this election than it did the last one?
You know, it's probably because Clinton was so incredibly unpopular. The name Clinton was so incredibly unpopular within the military. Some of that was fair. Some of it wasn't. Some of it was the legacy of her husband that I think had a tough reputation in the military. Democrats in general were effectively branded by Republicans as soft on defense. I don't think that's necessarily fair, but it was the rap for, you know, really decades. Even John Kerry, a veteran himself, had to tip against that. So, you know, Republicans get the default, but this situation will be different in part if Biden's personal connection. Bo Biden served in Iraq. You know, Joe Biden is a Blue Star dad. The extensive experience in national foreign policy space. If he talks in those terms and he highlights those parts of his resume, I think he will definitely do better than Clinton and chip away at Trump, even in his base among the moderates.
You think if you and I were going to make a beer and a burger wager on what happens in November, which side do you want?
Right now, I think Trump loses. I mean, this could change, but the way it's trending right now, he looks like he's in real trouble. And if I think Biden's biggest challenge right now is staying healthy. You know, I think he's got to stay in the basement. His biggest threat right now is probably the COVID rather than Trump. You know, they want to keep him in the basement, keep his health.
How big a deal is who he picks as VP?
You know, I don't know, Chris. I think it's something that he can screw up. I think if he makes an easy pick to appease a certain constituency within the party, it could divide the party rather than later. If I was advising, I might wait as long as you can, because then you keep all the tribes together until the 11th hour, and then when he does make his pick, then they'll cut each other up, which is what they're going to do anyway, because Democrats always eat their own. But I think he does have to think about some of the issues we're talking about, and they're laying on resume when it comes to national security and defense. The question you've always got to ask about a VP is, if the president dies, is that person ready to be made or chief? Is that person ready to lead our military, to have their finger on the nukes? And that's a tough question for someone like Stacey Abrams, who's never been in an executive position, who's never served in the military, doesn't really have any foreign policy experience. I think that's where her resume is revealed, and other outside candidates might look more formidable.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big deal because of what you said in there in passing, which is Democrats eat their own. And I think that the big test for them is, do they get to a place where Trump is a binary proposition, you know, that it is an existential choice, a threat driving the choice, so that it's anybody but Trump. And if they are not there, not just in terms of talk, but walk, and they're not there right now, you can't win unless you're all in. It's too thin. The margins, you know, these polls of... they only matter in the states that matter, and they only matter in those states and the counties that they matter. I mean, that's how close it is. Unless we see a blowout in here, which I don't believe reflects the reality in this country. You know, there are a lot of people on the other side, not on the Confederate flag issue. I mean, I think that that's a niche play for Trump, because everybody who wants the flag in play is probably a supporter of his. So he's got to play like that. Same reason he's quiet about George Floyd, because of that. He's completely self-centered in politics. But people will forgive that because that's what politicians tend to be. And him saying, I'm going to bring the military into Washington if you don't step up, Inslee, that doesn't hurt him. People aren't looking at Posse Comitatus. They're not looking at the Emergency Act of 1807 or whatever the hell that thing is about when he can bring in military, you know, if they ask him locally or whatever. People don't read it that way. They read it as strength, Peach.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. There comes a point where some strength is not throwing a punch, Chris. And this guy always wants to throw a punch instead of take a punch. And I think the American public understands that we got to figure out a way to de-escalate the situation. And, you know, you can't use a hammer every single time. There's a big difference between, you know, the National Guard in New York, which I've served in, and, you know, the active duty 82nd Airborne, which I've served alongside of. They do different things. And it's an escalation of political force to use different units and to bring them in from the outside. Which you know, they're not from there, they're not as familiar with the terrain and the community. It's similar to policing in a lot of ways, but I also hope that some of these National Guard units can show the cops how it's done. You know, many of us have been across from protesters, we've had stuff thrown at us, we've had stuff shot at us, and a lot of cops in this country have never had that experience. So they haven't, you know, performed as well, I think, as our National Guard has. And they're all going to be tested. But strength comes in a lot of form, and I think right now people are becoming more sophisticated about it, Chris. I think, you know, your brother's shown it. You know, I'm not going to miss an opportunity to tell you that. I think he's shown strength through kindness. He's shown strength through love. He's shown strength through restraint. And I think that's resonated with people of all parties.
Look, he did very well in that crisis phase with COVID and giving strength and consistency and transparency when it seemed the president wasn't. The governor of Whitmer in Michigan, Murphy in New Jersey, DeWine in Ohio, Hogan in Maryland, and a couple others, Newsom in California, Lamont in Connecticut, kudos on the same level. Did they get as much love as Andrew? Well, Andrew is New York, and he had me. And the Cuomo brothers thing became another kind of touchstone for people desperate for familiarity and comfort. You know, we're all hiding at home. We all don't know what's going to happen. Everything is so strange. And at least this is something that they understand. Brothers who love each other and they screw around with each other. And they're both involved in this mix. So that you get some more attachment to the people who are giving you the information you need in the moment. And it was always intentional, right? I mean, my joking with him was intentional to show another side of him and to lighten up the mood for people. And the duration of it was intentional. I was never going to keep having him on as the situation continued because I can't have him on. You know, I had him on during a special moment where there was no reason to call him out in any real way. And now there's going to be scrutiny and accountability and others have to do that. I can't do it even if I am more of a hammer than most people who will interview him. You can't do that with your own brother. It's flawed from the beginning. However, Peach, then you look at this situation. Andrew does not get the same love. He has people upset at him about what he said about police. He has people upset at him about what he said for the police and against the police. And he does not seem to have the same control. And they do not like the actions the same way. Why? Because this is a different issue. People have a lot of baked-in feelings about race and what needs to change and what doesn't need to change in a way that doesn't apply in COVID. Do you appreciate that distinction?
Yeah, and I think it's the most dynamic political battlefield we've ever seen. We're facing, in my view right now, kind of three epic tornadoes, if you will. You've got COVID, you've got the protests, and you've got the election. And they're all overlapping at different times. They're all separating at different times. But there's three firestorms that are constantly happening. And if you're a politician, you've got to be, you know, looking at three different pots on the stove, and you got to keep all those temperatures right. And I think, you know, what your brother ultimately showed and what you showed was authenticity. People that are being real and showing, you know, at times powerful vulnerability, but all confidence. You know, the ability to execute. Chips are down, and that frankly hasn't been traditionally a competence of Democrats. That's been something that Republicans have trumpeted. So, you know, I think it comes down to authenticity, but also being dynamic. and they've got to be able to stay, you know, in line with the press cycle, understand where the people are, understand where the issues are. And the one thing that I think is actually giving momentum is, you know, the far left talking about defund the police. Defund the police is a gift to Trump when he needs it most. You know, I know it's not what they necessarily mean, all of them, but that terminology is a gift to Trump, and I think it's the only momentum he's got right now, is the ability to twist that up and run with that as far as he can.
Well, they handed it to him. You know, the left does that. And why? Because there is a different ownership mentality of the party on the right than there is on the left. The left is more about relative levels of disagreement and disappointment, right? Everything is settling on the left. Yeah. On the right, they have their core principles. Can I keep my gun? Is it wrong for women to exercise any control over their own bodies? And can you talk about God a lot? And less government is more. And boy, this emerging culture of diversity is crazy. You say all of those five things in any measure, you're good. You're good.
Yeah, and you know what else is too, Chris?
That doesn't pass on the left. Yes.
It's a very simple leadership trait. It's discipline, right? Rogers used to say, I'm not a member of an organized party. I'm a Democrat. Republicans have been disciplined. You know, even if they're offline on the issue, they stay united. They stay focused. They stay mobilized. And the Democrats eat their own. You can always count on them to do that. The question is, can Biden be that Jon Snow in Game of Thrones that brings together all the tribes, all the different assets together to fight the White Walker that is Trump? That's the real question for Biden. And I think the real challenge for him is to not be out in front, but to kind of be like Ellen. He's got to be a talk show host and bring in all his cool friends. And if he brings in, you know, Michelle Obama, and he brings in Kamala Harris, and he brings in a diversity of voices that can amplify the overall position, then he's a monster. And then if he can't wrangle all those different voices, then it's going to be death by democracy, and he's going to lose.
Well, he's got to be a big wee guy, because he's not enough by himself. There's no question about that. He ain't Obama. He ain't Clinton in terms of connecting with a lot of people on what he means personally. A lot of that is out of his control. It's just dispositive of age and stage. We were talking about his son, Bo, earlier. You know, bias alert. Bo was a friend of mine. And I'm telling you, if that cat had lived, we would not be having any of these conversations right now. The only problem would have been convincing Bo to run for president. Because he did not seek power. That cat passed up higher office twice to do things he thought were more important. One was finishing the prosecution with this demon doctor in his state that had some of the most abuse ever we've ever seen of children. And the second time was to go to Iraq.
Right.
And, you know, both times it was not politically advantageous to him, but he did it anyway. And that's the kind of guy he was. So other than getting him to want to run and leave his state or whatever capacity he would have been in at the time, I think he would have blown this field away. And of course you exaggerate and you lionize when people are dead. But I said this when he was alive. You know, he reminded me of Paul, what's his name? The guy from Wisconsin, Ryan, when he first came in before he sold out when he became speaker. You know, I'm going to spend time with my kids. I'm down with the fiscal thing. If you're not down with the fiscal thing, get out of my face, and I'm not going to argue against everything the Democrats want and demonize them. It's not worth my time. I want to get shit done. I respected that about him. He changed. Bo never did, but he also didn't get a chance because he's gone. And you got Biden, Bernie, pretty quiet. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker. You know, he needs the super friends. You know, I was pitching an idea back in the day that at the convention, what they needed to do, you know, and this was when we didn't know that there'd be COVID. Peach, my idea was it's going to be Biden. You got to get Bernie okay with that, and in a way that was way different than he was with Clinton and what happened after that convention, and then go pure super friends or Avengers or whatever metaphor you want. And Buttigieg is going to take this position. Yang is going to take this position. Harris is going to take this position. Booker is going to take this position. And all the people you like in different measures are going to be vetted and in place and known as part of a team that you've never had access to before. You've never seen people who are going to take major positions in our government that really matter vetted at the level that these people were. You know them. You like them to different degrees. Many of them almost or more than you like me. But they're all on board, and we're going to run as a slate against one man who's all about himself. Yeah. And I thought that that was their best chance, but they don't seem anywhere near that. Your take.
No, Chris, they may be doing that, and maybe they're all rested. Because, I mean, the toll that the last couple of years has probably taken on all of them, the thing that I think is still available to them is not only are they open to media, right? So you've got this full-spectrum attack of everybody from Cory Booker to Buttigieg to Yang to Harris, right? And if they really put the pedal down and unleash all these folks at the same time, they're going to be on every channel sounding and looking good. And that's the real opportunity that they have. And they haven't even really ramped up, you know, Obama, both Obamas, Michelle and Barack. If they do that, they have a chance to flood the airwaves and be everywhere, not just on the cable news shows and the Sunday shows, but on shows like Ellen and Colbert and in the pop culture. That's the real chance for them to kind of take back that populist energy that Trump's got and outnumber him and just swamp him in media. That's the opportunity they have. And I think the COVID environment actually benefits that strategy if can pull it off, right? If they can get them all together, and that's the hard part.
Amen, brother. I appreciate you as always. Thank you for the help to the show. Thank you for the help to the country. As you all know, but must be reminded, PJ has an amazing podcast called The Angry American. If you're not angry, you're not paying attention. You should listen. You can get it where you get all podcasts. I love being on it. I love who he has beside me even more. Very provocative, open, decent, progressive in terms of pushing ideas. Partisanship is nowhere in play. PJ, I love you. Best to you, the wife, and the kids.
Thank you, my friend. Back at you, and the Camaro sends its love.
Well done. You nailed it that night. Awesome, as always. All right, let's take a break. 866-967-6887. Let's get after it.